Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I should correct you. While at Yale, I was doing the wave equation on the Heisenberg group. It's a pleasure to be in Vancouver. Michael asked me to give a survey talk. The good news there is that if you're not in the field, which most of you aren't, you won't be bored for an hour on details for one problem. The bad news is that much of the joy is in the details, and we'll be missing that. Medical imaging is a big field. Most of it does not involve mathematicians. So to give you an idea, in Toronto, I estimate there are about the ratio of researchers in medical imaging to mathematicians in medical imaging is about at least 50-1. And this is talking PIs. So before I got to Toronto in 2001, this ratio was, I'm guessing, infinity. So as you can see, math can have a great impact. But kidding aside, from the mathematician's point of view, this is a field which has beautiful problems, simple to state and hard to solve. There's some gorgeous mathematical structure behind them, which I like to describe as nonlinear harmonic analysis. And on the other hand, there's a potential for tremendous impact. The first such thing was done in computer tomography. I understand that Richard Froese gave a course about this in the fall, so you're all experts on this. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to try to add a word to my title, talk about nonlinear. And so computer tomography is based on X-rays. X-rays have a lot of energy, so they go through you in straight lines. If you think instead of something like ultrasound, tissue differences bounce. There's a lot of reflection, diffraction of ultrasound. So if you think of the path naively, it is not straight, and it depends on the thing you're trying to find in the first place. So I'm interested in such nonlinear inverse problems. The mathematics, I think, is very nice and interesting. And on the other hand, in terms of impact, if I forget to say it later, imagine that we could replace, you do a little mathematics, and you can replace testing or checking for breast cancer, which is currently done with X-rays. Suppose you could do it instead with ultrasound, right? That's more than a mathematician can dream of in terms of impact. So here's the plan of the talk. These are the things I would like to talk about. I realized while preparing this that I probably won't have time to mention number four. So number one is the electric impedance tomography problem, which in terms of the mathematics, this nonlinear mathematics I'm talking about, is the most developed. In terms of applications, it's in some sense the most disappointing, through no fault of ours, but just the nature of the problem, as I will try to explain. Something I've been doing more recently is we've dubbed current density impedance imaging. And then I still have a project going on in quantitative high-resolution ultrasound. Number four, if you're interested, ask me in the question period. It's an instance in when I started in this imaging business, I was told MRI is all understood. It's just the Fourier transform, right? So that's no new mathematics. Well, it turns out, I learned this from Charlie Epstein, that in the design of the MRI apparatus, in the fields you're trying to make, there is interesting mathematics. The mathematics is the Bloch equation, and the Bloch equation in the spin domain is really the Zakharov-Shabbat system. So something which was developed to solve nonlinear problems such as nonlinear Schrödinger turns out to be directly useful in making better MRI machines. So, item number one has had a very active mathematical energy devoted to it, partly because it was posed by Calderon in 1980, and that made it respectable, and he said, put it in writing that he couldn't do it, so that made it respectable for analysts to look at this problem carefully. As I said, problems that are simple to state, here it is stated with no mathematics at all. The issue is, suppose that you go to the doctor puts electrodes on you as they would for an EKG, but instead we'd like to have an image of the variable conductivity inside your body. So different, right, we have great pictures with MRI. Why are we looking for other kinds of pictures? Well, different modalities, X-ray, ultrasound, electric impedance tomography, are attempting to image different tissue properties. So they give you different information for diagnostic purposes. And so here's the problem. Can we find the electric conductivity inside, say, your body by making voltage and current measurements at the surface? Here are some applications of this. Initially, Calderon thought of this as a problem in geophysics. You make the measurements on the surface of the Earth and try to say something about the what's under the surface. And you can find the paper along those lines as far back as 1933 for a half plane by Langer. In medical imaging, this has been called the electric impedance tomography problem. Since, for instance, if you have liquid in the lungs, that changes the conductivity, so it's something you could detect. Similarly, in newborn, if there's brain hemorrhage, which is a problem for often for newborn, for premature babies, well, you can't keep them under an X-ray machine to try to monitor them continuously, but with some weak currents, you can imagine you could try to, and again, there would be a great conductivity change if there's brain hemorrhage. There's also some work on breast cancer, not so much for imaging, but for combining this with other modalities in deciding on whether it is a yay or a nay. So I would call that detection as opposed to imaging. So let me describe the problem mathematically, just to give you an idea of the math structure involved. So this is what my body looks like mathematically. It's a domain in Rn. It has a conductivity, which for now we assume is a scalar positive function. Then gamma and U is the voltage potential. So gamma grad U, so that's voltage drop times conductivity, which is the same as voltage drop divided by resistance, is the current. This equation says divergence of the current is zero. That's a basic equation when there are no sources or sinks of current. So here's a forward, what we would call a forward problem. I give you a potential F on the surface. I give you the conductivity of the body. Find the voltage potential inside. That's a standard Dirichlet problem that we study in PDEs. Now, given that F, hold on to that U, and now let's suppose we look at a normal component of gamma grad U, normal component of the current. So if we have that for any given F, that's what engineers would call the voltage to current map. So you give me the Dirichlet data and the corresponding Neumann data. This map is called the Dirichlet to Neumann map. And so that's a nice, elegant mathematical way of encoding the boundary information. And the inverse problem is, from this additional information on the boundary, try to recover gamma. So gamma is the unknown conductivity in the body. If you can calculate that, you could map it as an image and show how it changes from organ to organ. So the problem Calderon posed is, does knowledge of this operator on the boundary determine the conductivity inside? In other words, is this map from gamma to lambda gamma injective? If you have two conductivities, can they produce the same boundary measurements? So even though lambda gamma itself as a function of F is a linear map, right? If you put F1 plus F2 on the boundary, you'll get the currents adding up correspondingly. Its dependence on the conductivity, so this map, is nonlinear, very much nonlinear. And so that's why I would call this a nonlinear inverse problem, as opposed to in CAT, the Radon transform is a linear operator. And to make a long story short, in one dimension, this is not enough information. If you just have a wire and you measure the voltage and conductivity at the endpoints, you can only get the average of the resistivity inside, nothing more. But in dimensions 2 and higher, we now know the answer is yes. This data does determine the conductivity inside. And so this problem, let me just take a few minutes into a digression from applied math into just math. This problem has become a mini field. There have been these three thick dots here that denote at least 10 papers which were trying to prove uniqueness for less and less smooth conductivity. So that's a mathematical exercise. A spectacular recent result by Astara and Paivarinta showed that in fact for L infinity, so that's bounded measurable conductivity with no smoothness assumed, you get uniqueness. And that uses a specialty of Astala. Kari Astala is quasi-conformal maps in the plane. I'm going to try to give you a few open problems, and here's one. Try to prove the same in dimensions 3 and higher. So here, if you like harmonic analysis, this is most likely to involve harmonic analysis tools, careful estimates. We then understood that if you know the Dirichlet to Neumann map, and if you know what happens outside omega, then you can go from the data on this boundary to the data at infinity, and thereby solve inverse scattering problems, which have been open for 30, 40 years. And then people like these developments so much, there have been analogs for Maxwell's equations, for elastic media, for nonlinear media, where, let's say, the conductivity depends itself nonlinearly on the voltage, and so forth. So this is a subfield now of partial differential equations called inverse problems. Let me also mention the connection to geometry. In practice, conductivity is certainly in certain parts of the body, like the heart or the corpus callosum in the brain, is anisotropic. We model that with a tensor, or if you wish, a matrix-valued conductivity. And here are the equations, and similar, you can define a Dirichlet to Neumann map for that and ask, suppose I measure the Dirichlet to Neumann map, does that determine a an anisotropic conductivity? Well, the quick answer is no. It was observed by Luc Tartar that essentially if you change variables inside the domain, that will produce a conductivity which will give you the same measurement on the boundary if you leave the boundary unchanged. So you can't tell conductivity gamma from its push forward by a diffeomorphism. And so the natural conjecture is, well, is that the only obstruction to uniqueness? Suppose two conductivities have the same Dirichlet to Neumann maps, can you get from one to the other by a diffeomorphism? In dimension two, that's, the answer is yes, and that can be reduced using isothermal coordinates to the isotropic problem which I solved. So in dimensions three and higher, the problem is open, and you can, in dimensions three and higher, you can make it, you can state it equivalent to the following problem of differential geometry. If you write out the, suppose they think of this as a metric or something, there's a formula that connects this to a Riemannian metric in this domain, to a Riemannian metric in this domain, so that the conductivity equation becomes precisely the Laplace-Beltrami equation for a harmonic function on a Riemannian manifold. And so even if you're an engineer, if you care about anisotropic conductivities, and I will show you that they do, you're forced to learn Riemannian geometry, right there. And the question can be restated in the following way. Given this domain or the manifold with boundary, is there, and two metrics, gamma 1, gamma 2, or G1, G2, if the two metrics are isometric, meaning that there is a diffeomorphism that takes one to the other, then they produce the same Dirichlet to Neumann map, because they produce essentially the same harmonic functions. Is the converse true? If the you're sitting on the boundary, this is a in some sense a problem that Riemann asked when he invented Riemannian geometry. How can you tell if two metrics are isometric? Now, locally, the answer is in terms of Riemannian curvature. But then there's this issue of you compare the Riemannian curvature here with where the diffeomorphism would take it, and it sort of becomes messy, and you have to follow geodesics and parallel transport and so forth. Here, you'd be just sitting at the boundary, looking at boundary values of harmonic functions, and it would tell you if the Dirichlet to Neumann maps are the same, the two Riemannian manifolds are isometric. I don't know if this is of use in practice, but it's certainly a gorgeous problem. And so there's a second open problem. If you don't like harmonic analysis and you prefer geometry, you can work on this one. And so we're in good shape with the mathematics of this. It's nicely evolved. It has beautiful structure. So the challenge is to make it practical, to somehow tie in with the applications that engender these problems. And when I tried to prove my uniqueness theorem, I somehow resisted trying to just have a uniqueness result, which tends to be proved by contradiction. You know, suppose two conductivities give you the same measurement, it's impossible. But instead try to make it constructive. So let me quickly summarize. So this is a cartoon of at least the 2D proof. First, you make a change from conductivities to potentials in a little Schrödinger equation. That's a detail, but that is why I needed two derivatives, and this is where the progress is now. Using quasi-conformal maps, you don't need to make this change to Schrödinger. So the plan is the following. You define something I call the scattering transform, And I just wrote it down here so you shouldn't think it's some sort of fancy abstract or vague object. It's a very concrete thing. You solve a Schrödinger equation with solutions that behave in a certain way. These are non-physical solutions that grow exponentially in some directions. You prove estimates to show these things exist. And once you have such a solution, this formula defines for you the scattering transform of the potential Q. And then I showed that from the Dirichlet to Neumann map, by solving a family of linear integral equations on the boundary, you get the scattering transform. Of course, I don't expect you to understand the details from this slide, but just you should know what's going on a little bit. And then separately, once you have the scattering transform, you do linear integral equations in the complex case plane, and you recover the conductivity.
What's
x bar? X bar is x1 minus ix2. So I call P a nonlinear Fourier transform. Why is that? Well, it's nonlinear. Psi depends nonlinearly on Q. So this depends nonlinearly on Q. But if you linearize it, the linear piece of T is the Fourier transform. So it's nonlinear, and its linear part is the Fourier transform. And moreover, it has properties very analogous to the Fourier transform. So for variations of this T, we have even a Plancherel theorem. We have a Fourier inversion formula, and so forth. And so if nothing else, these problems lead you by the nose into nonlinear harmonic analysis. So I tried to convince some numericists to work this out, and they said I was crazy. This is much, much worse. When you see what these integral equations look like, this is much more complicated than the typical numerical algorithm. But some people took it seriously, specifically Jennifer Muller and Samuli Siltanen. Jennifer is in Colorado now. Samuli is in Helsinki. David Isaacson is at RPI, has been a great proponent of electric impedance tomography. So all the results I'm going to show you from now on are on experimental data. You can play lots of tricks on synthetic data to make things look great. For the mathematicians in the audience, I should say, when you see results on experimental data, that's an order of magnitude additional effort. It tells you not only that your method is, let's say, stable under measurement errors, it tells you that the method works with non-ideal data, right? I stated the problem as a continuous one. Here, we have a setup with 32 electrodes. It tells you that the model is right. I mean, here we are, we were in a bath, and we put salt in it, and we put electricity. Who says that we have the right equations modeling that? So this is their so-called chest phantom with two lungs and then a heart with different conductivity. And what you're looking at is about, I think, 5 or 6 years of effort that it took for them to implement my method numerically and produce this result, which, thank goodness, is a better result than what you can get from a no-brainer, let's say, Newton method. So the Newton method gives them about a 40% error. This is about a 20% error. But as you see, it's disappointing. And right, doctors look at this and say, why should I invest in EIT? It's going to give us crummy pictures. And the reason that the pictures are crummy is that the problem itself is very ill-posed. So it's not our fault. It's not the fault of the method so much as the fact that, in some sense, exponentially big changes here can give you almost indistinguishable measurements at the boundary. So as an imaging tool, this is limited use. So in particular, I wasn't very interested myself in working with this in practice. Then I came to Toronto, Hogtown, and I met Mike Joy in electrical engineering. And Mike Joy had an idea 10, 12 years ago to use MRI machines in an original way. MRI machines measure magnetic fields. Here's one of the Maxwell's equations. So if I have the magnetic field B, I can hope to calculate the current density. So in my notation from before, J would be gamma grad U. And so they call this current density imaging. And so, for instance, Philips, who makes, among other things, defibrillators, is interested when you put these electrodes on a person. Well, we'll put them on a pig first. Where does the current go? And that's the sort of actual measurement. So the image of the pig is from an MRI image on which we superimpose the calculation of integral curves of this vector field J. So that's what they have been doing. Let me show you. So again, this is actual measurements on a heart. And what you see is really gorgeous, that the integral curves for the current density tends to follow the fibers in the heart. And you see here, I said before, anisotropic medium, you see very much that this behaves very differently in some directions depending on the muscle fibers of the heart than in others. And so when I came on the scene, my thought was, wait a minute, if you have current densities, maybe we can measure, we can use them to calculate conductivities. And that should be a better posed problem. In fact, it's quite interesting, it's in some a new kind of inverse problem, where instead of just having information on the boundary, we now have information from the inside of the object. So magically, the MRI machine gives me some information on the inside. There's a similar idea in ultrasound where they have, it's called sonoelasticity. So they have an elastic wave sent through the body, and then they use Doppler in ultrasound to image the velocity field of that wave. So there again, it's a way to get information inside and hopefully have a better behaved inverse problem. And so this isn't very hard. You can, with an afternoon of work, find a formula where if I give you one current isn't enough, but if I give you two different current densities, you can calculate the corresponding conductivity for isotropic conductors. And so we spent a few years trying to test this experimentally. On what we call tissue phantoms. So these are man-made things which we control and try to image. And since we control them, we can tell how good the imaging method is. So this is something that they make at the in Toronto. It's the sort of artificial bone material which we plunge in saline. And remember before we look at the results, that there are only four electrodes here. Whereas in the picture I showed you before, there are 32. So there are minimal boundary measurements, if you wish. Most of the measurement is obtained by putting this into an MRI machine and getting information about the magnetic field, as I indicated. And so here are the results. This is plotted. So these are isoconductivity surface and this is a slice through it. Here's another slice. So even though we only have four electrodes, the results are pretty good and they stay pretty sharp inside. I should say the picture from before, there's a lot of smoothing of the answers here. We're not doing that. So we dubbed this not CDI, but CDII, current density impedance imaging. So my contribution was to add an I to the whole process. Let me tell you some of the challenges in this. This is not such a trivial problem as it first seems. If you start to try to think about MRI machines, you will find that in fact you don't measure the magnetic field. I lied to you before. You only measure one component of it, the one along the huge magnetic field of your MRI machine. So now restate the whole problem. Can you do that if I just give you one component of the magnetic field? And remember, you want to take a curl of that. So it's sort of tough to take the curl of a vector field when you just know one component. And you somehow have to cup here. So here's the what you can get from the Z component of B. You somehow now have to couple this with the PDE. There are some very nice preliminary results saying that this might work by a Korean team where Seo is the mathematician, Wu is the head engineer. So this is a group which has a funding of on the order of, let's say, $10 million for about this many years devoted to this specific problem. They have two MRI machines at their disposal to play with. When we want to do MRI experiments, we have to run to the hospital and beg them for a little time. Numerous numerical analysts, graduate students, postdocs, all of that on this one problem. And they have some numerical evidence that, yes, you can reconstruct the conductivity just from this Z component of the magnetic field, but no uniqueness results, no convergence, and some questions. So that's one challenge. That's open problem number three for you. Open problem number four, what about anisotropic conductivities? So here, if you believe the conjecture that somehow they should be the same up to diffeomorphism, I think this breaks the diffeomorphism. This interior data would allow you to find it if you have enough currents. So that's item two. Now for something completely different. What do they say in Monty Python? If I can only find it. Ultrasound. Here's a so-so picture of a baby in the womb done with ultrasound. You can find better pictures. Let me tell you why, how this is obtained, the basic idea. It's enough to make a mathematician cry. So so we're now talking about ultrasound imaging. If you smooth the way for electric impedance tomography, it's time to wake up, this is something else. Or the other way around, you can now go to sleep with, I'm done with electric impedance tomography. We now want to image with ultrasound. What is ultrasound? It's simply sound that has frequency higher than we can hear. Why do we care to have such high frequency? Because that has a short wavelength, and short wavelength means better resolution. So here's the basic idea behind the picture I showed you as it is used in current ultrasound machines in doctor's offices. You have an array or of about, let's say, 128 little emitters, which is placed on the skin. they put all right, so let me skip the details, but basically you send in a pulse and you say, this problem is complicated, let's make a few simplifying approximations. Let's say the speed of sound in tissue is constant, even though it is the variations in speed of sound that we're trying to find. Let's say that the speed of sound is known, even though that's what we're after. How is it known? Well, I measure it on 1,000 patients and I take the average, so I know the speed of sound. Let me assume that sound travels in straight lines, although we know from experiment that it does not. And let's just assume that when something travels in straight line to a scatterer, it hits it and comes back without bouncing around to other scatterers. So we're ignoring the fact that we're ignoring multiple scattering, which is what makes the problem nonlinear. So how does that go? Well, we send a pulse and back comes a function of time, right? We're listening now in the same place. It's a backscattering setup. And here comes this function of time. And we see, whoops, at one microsecond, I seem to have a blip. That means that half a microsecond away, right? It took half a microsecond to go there and half a microsecond to come back. There must have been a scatter. I know where that is because I know the speed of sound. So I place it on that line. And in fact, I don't need to do any math. I don't even need to do this distances. I can just turn this into a gray level and put it on this line and then move to another line. And that's how I get this. Of course, there are signal processing tricks of focusing the beams to stay on that line and so forth. It's quite sophisticated by now in signal processing terms, but the math is about what I described. And if you think that's disappointing, someone had the idea of taking these 2D pictures and stacking them up. That's again a technical challenge because you need to know, right, you're holding this in your hand, you need to have a detector of where, which plane the picture came from. So once you solve that, you get twins. So I would call this, to paraphrase some famous words, the unreasonable effectiveness of kindergarten mathematics. So this is not a great scientific breakthrough, but you can tell that everyone, right, will want to have a picture of their newborn in 3D. So, all right, so what are we here for? This is working great. Well, suppose you want to use ultrasound to make, to detect breast cancer. It's not good enough for that. Number one, the resolution is not fine enough. Number two, the picture is qualitative. It simply tells you there's something there. It doesn't give you numbers on the speed of sound and so forth. And so, for instance, in the detection of breast cancer, there are these so-called microcalcifications, which are associated with onset of cancer. And in a picture full of speckle like this, you can't tell them apart from the noise. And so with Bob Wagon, superb electrical engineering in Rochester, the thought was that if we could make a quantitative high resolution picture, we would be able to tell, for instance, calcium from tissue by having different numbers. Even if, so if you have, let's say, in colors for the doctor, the quantitative version, you would be able to have more reliable ultrasound pictures. And so all of a sudden, that gets us from this sort of geometric acoustics to wave acoustics. And you're going from kindergarten mathematics to state-of-the-art mathematics. We now have a PDE, a wave equation, variable speed, that's what we're after. We measure the pressure somewhere at the surface, and from that we want to find the speed inside. Again, an inverse problem, and again, nonlinear. P depends nonlinearly, as I will show you, on the speed of sound. So let me quickly set up the problem at fixed frequency. At first you may be tempted to work in the time domain with hyperbolic equations, but in fact when you work with ultrasound, the frequency, it's ultrasound, it's centered around a certain value. And so typical tricks that people in hyperbolic differential equations would be tempted to do, like go to low limit as frequency goes to zero or limit as frequency goes to infinity, you're not allowed to do those. So it's actually safer to work at fixed frequency. Here it is. Take a Fourier transform in T, and K is roughly your... and so here you can think, here's the basic setup. You send in a plane wave. We can manufacture those. I should show you what I have in mind experimentally. So we designed this together, and it was built not by us, but by an outfit in Japan. So I think this is the finest instrument for measuring ultrasound in existence. It's a cylinder with water, which is very good for ultrasound. And in one plane of the cylinder, you have 2,048 little transducers of sending and emitting ultrasound. They're spaced less than half a wavelength apart. So you need, the wavelength is on the order of a millimeter. You need a magnifying glass to tell them apart. And imagine the wiring job. And here is a dedicated multiplexer which can send a signal to any one of these and collect from any one of the others and so forth. So what I'm describing here, for that wavelength, we may as well think of the water tank as the whole space. And doing scattering, we check this. It does behave like a scattering problem. We can create something like a plane wave. It hits the object. And then we measure, in the direction theta, what is called far away, the far field pattern or scattering amplitude. So again, the map from speed of sound to this is nonlinear. The linearization is called the Born approximation, and it fails miserably in this context. Where is it? Failure of Born approximation. Here it is. If you have a cylinder in green here, and you measure that and you try to reconstruct it using the linearized version, which is what's most often done, you get the, let's see, the real part is in blue. So typically you pick out the edges fairly well, but what's inside gets lost. And of course we're very interested in something like the breast. We're very interested in an accurate reconstruction inside. So here's roughly what your data looks like. It's somewhat similar to seismograms. So here are your 2,048 lines, one for each of the transducer or angle if you wish, and this is time. So this is the forward part of the wave, right, which hits at zero. That's the first thing you see at zero. At 180, which is the back part, here, for instance, you get the reflection from the wall of the cylinder and then multiple reflections inside. So I've been telling you about how important math is. Now let me tell you how important engineering is. As a mathematician, you might not pay much attention to this, plus or minus 100 dB is the quality of these measurements. That's a sign of a tremendous engineer. It's also a sign of a lot of money. So we argued about this because it costs, I would estimate, about two postdocs to get this kind of dB. And why not live with 60 dBs? Well, with 60 dBs, you wouldn't see any of these multiple scattering. So no matter how fine your nonlinear math method is, the data wouldn't be there. All right, that's what engineering is for. What is the math for? Well, turning this into the image of the object we're trying to probe. So let me quickly, how much time do I have?
8 minutes.
Okay, so I'll quickly describe the idea. It's somewhat disappointing as far as the math, although it was quite exciting when we first did it. So you can take that function A of theta alpha and think of it as an operator, the scattering operator far away at infinity. And let's suppose Fi is an eigenfunction of this. So if you discretize, this is just a matrix, and Fi is an eigenvector. Think of that as an input pattern. So here's a fact which was discovered by Fink in France and his collaborators. Suppose you take that eigenfunction of the scattering operator far away, and you send it back. So you create a field. So this is a solution of the wave equation, which looks like little fi far away. And let's say we start with a very simple setup with two-point scatterers, one stronger and one weaker. So let's think, what does an eigenfunction do? What's the first eigenvector do? It maximizes the first eigenvalue. So if you write this out, you'll see that means you want somehow with the eigenvector, think of it as the input, you want it to arrange it so as to get the maximum output. So what are you going to do? You're going to send everything to the stronger scatterer. And sure enough, if you take the first eigenvector of the scattering operator, create the corresponding wave, you will see that it focuses on the stronger scattering. And amusingly, if you take the second eigenvector, make its wave, you'll see, so it's sort of like subtracting this, and then what's the best thing you can do? It focuses on the next scatter. So the thought was, well, why don't we try to recreate our object as a superposition of these things which have somehow maximal energy sent back to where we want it. That failed miserably. And here I'm borrowing a slide from my collaborator. Here's what he tells at engineering conferences. Retransmitted eigenfunctions observed to focus energy on distributive inhomogeneities. So we generalized Fink's observation to general object, not just point scatterers. Linear combinations of these fields did not yield good images. And then I remembered from the analytic work on the Calderon problem that it's not solutions of the PDE that are dense, which is what we're doing here, right? We're expanding in terms of solutions of the PDE. It's products of solutions. So think about harmonic functions, right? If you have a typical function, say, in the plane, to make it easy, and think of its Taylor series, right? You can't expand it in terms of harmonic functions. But if I allow you products of harmonic functions, then you have Z and Z bar and products of solutions are dense. So I suggested that to the postdoc who was working at the time, and sure enough, that worked much better. So here quickly is what it is. You take these retransmitted fields and you try to find the coefficients which would give you the correct potential or speed of sound. So these turn out to be Lagrange multipliers in some minimization problem. So basically take this whole expansion, put it back in the formula for the amplitude and solve for the unknown coefficients. This works quite well. So what's the disappointment? The disappointment is that to send these eigenfunctions back through the medium, you need to know the medium. So, well, we don't know the medium, but what we can do is we can have a guess of it, or we can have somehow a rough idea of what it is, use that to create these fields, and then get to work. And so here's the result. Again, this again on experimental data. This is what conventional B-scan does. So this is a phantom, a breath-mimicking phantom, where we have three wires, which are usually put in to see how fine your resolution is. And we have two, in here, we have, they're called glass beads, but it's in fact glass dust, which is thrown into this mixture. So there are people, this is a highly interdisciplinary adventure. You need mathematicians, you need engineers, you need numerical analysts. There are people who make it their life's work to build phantoms. That's all they do. So these are little point scatterers. And we simply tricked the B-scan machine. Here are two regions where there is no wire, no glass beads. And as you see, no echoes come back. You can sort of tell, by the way, where the B-scan is from, right? Because you get a big reflection here, right? So it's coming from this direction. And here's our reconstruction, which reproduces the wires and these two regions, which have in fact the same speed of sound as the outside, but the absence of these little scatterers didn't bother us. And here it is quantitatively. This is a slice through here, these two wires and that region inside. That's the conventional B-scan. As I claimed before, it's non-quantitative. And here is what I claim is a quantitative method. It gives you the correct speed of sound and very nice resolution for less than a wavelength for the two wires. What's disappointing about this? Well, that we had to tell the machine that somehow this is in the background a cylinder. And that's what we used for our somehow our first guess. So despite what various papers you might see in the literature, I think this problem, so let me tell you the status. The status for this problem. Uniqueness is proved in dimensions 3 and higher. It's an open problem in 2D. So there's one more theoretical open problem for you. It is true in 2D for low enough frequencies, because then it reduces to, you can use my method for in the Calderon problem, which you can think of as DC. So if you're close enough to DC, you have a uniqueness theorem. Otherwise, it's an open problem. 2D inverse scattering at fixed frequency. More importantly, I don't think there is a good, efficient algorithm out there for treating this inverse scattering for the wave equation in a good way. And as I said, the impact would be tremendous even in this one problem, but I'm sure in others as well. That's it.